herzlich willkommen zum Draußentester. Heute mit einem ganz außergewöhnlichen Gast, dem polnisch-US-amerikanischen Chemie-Nobelpreisträger Roald Hoffmann, der auf Einladung des NCCR Molecular Systems Engineering und der Camille und Henry Dreyfus Foundation die Schweiz besucht hat. Hoffmann, der auch Autor zahlreicher Theaterstücke und Lyrikwerke ist und als einer der ganz großen Wissenschaftskommunikatoren unserer Zeit gilt, war anlässlich der Weltpremiere seiner Oper Alchemy zu Gast in Basel. In diesem Podcast blicken wir zurück auf ein ganz außerordentliches Leben, das 1937 im polnischen Ort Solochiw begann und durch den Zweiten Weltkrieg zur Emigration in die Vereinigten Staaten führte. In den nächsten 60 Minuten hören wir einige sehr bewegende und fast schon unglaubliche Geschichten. Warum Roald seinen eigentlichen Nachnamen von Safran zu Hoffmann ändern musste? Warum es nicht immer ein purer Genuss ist, den Nobelpreis zu erhalten? Das und vieles mehr erfahrt ihr in diesem Podcast. Roald Hoffmann,
you were born on July 18th, 1937 into a Polish and Jewish family.
Yes.
Were your parents and maybe other close relatives practicing the Jewish religion?
Indeed, I was born in Poland in 1937. The family was Jewish. The practicing, this was now a matter of, as it was for Jews around the world, there are varying stages of assimilation, and very few are still the very observant, Orthodox, Torah-following Jews that we think of. And we think of them in, especially strange as we think of them, in a Hasidic dress and black outfits or such. Anyway, we were certainly not Hasidim. We were Jewish, and we were in a stage of assimilation which was typical of Polish Jews in that period, which German Jews had undergone a little earlier, and American Jews have undergone also. My grandparents were religious Jews, but they were not very religious. My grandfather wore a yarmulke, a kippah, but my parents were secular, and they were their names were Hillel and Clara. Rosen was my mother's maiden name. Safran was my father's name. They were not religious, but they did not fight very much about being not religious with their parents. Another way to say it is, whereas my uncles were named Abraham and Samuel, there was no way that I was going to get a name like Abraham or Samuel. And instead, Jews in the generation of that assimilation were given more secular names. For instance, Emil was a popular name because of Emil Zola, maybe. In my case, Roald was after a Norwegian explorer who died 10 years before I was born. My mother says she read an article in the newspaper. Now, they did give me a Hebrew name, and I was circumcised, so they were certainly sort of, they were definitely Jewish, but not religious.
But beyond that, religion or faith in a God has never played a role in your life.
Though I think of myself as somewhat unusually for a scientist, as an atheist who has a feeling for religious thought by others, and who is also interested in spiritual matters. And I think I understand religious people. And this shows up in a number of ways, but one of them is also, I have done at some point a book about issues of science and Jewish religious tradition, so I learned about my own tradition. In fact, that was when I did that book about 20 years ago, called Old Wine, New Flasks, together with an observant Jewish woman scholar. It was for the first time that I read the Talmud, but I could not read it in the original. I could read the Hebrew, but not the Aramaic parts, and they gave me trouble. So anyway, I have a religion does not play the direct part of my life, but I feel that I understand it.
You were born in a town called...
It's now called Zolochiv in Ukrainian, Zolochiv. It was a small town of 12,000 people, about 4,000 Jews, 4,000 Poles, 4,000 Ukrainians. The Jews felt themselves identifiably Polish, but the Ukrainians did not feel identifiably Polish. They were different. So that was interesting. The Jews partook of the educational system. It's interesting to see. The gymnasium, the highest level of education in this town, was a big thing to get a matura from the gymnasium. And there is a growing number of Jewish students in the gymnasium. We have the list of the graduates. It's very interesting.
So the town was Polish when you were born. Then it, between 1941 and 44, it was occupied by Germany. Then for a year it was occupied by the Red Army. And after that, until 1991, your birthplace was included in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And since 1991, it has been part of the independent Ukraine. What does home mean to you?
To describe that piece of the world to people, when my mother was born, it was Austria-Hungary. Same place, no different place. Her birth certificate is in Polish, in 1911, in Polish and German. And then we also were under Soviet occupation from 39 to 41, when the Soviets and Nazis callously divided Poland, just before the outbreak of the more serious fighting. Home to me is where my family is now, and where my children are, and that is the United States. But that's where I was born. The Ukrainians claim me as Ukrainian. The Poles say I'm Polish. That's fine. If I were to say to somebody what I am, I would say I'm a Polish Jew by origin and an American. In America, where we came at age, my age 11, has served as my home. It's where I got my education.
A lot of your family members were killed in the Holocaust. Your father was killed by the Germans in a labor camp. And when you were 9 years old, hid together with your mother for a year and a half in an attic and a room in your school, what kind of memories do you have of that time, and how much have they influenced your life up to this very day? Is that an everyday a memory for you, or how do you cope with that very difficult history of yours?
It is an everyday memory. I cope with it just fine. I'm not obsessed by it in any way. I think the first thing is that survival is most important, and we did survive. And to me, the act of survival is itself something which is a cause for optimism about human nature. We survived, a good man saved us and his family. But so many died, so many were betrayed, and the terrible obsession of the Nazis with killing the Jews led to the destruction of so many. There were three children out of the 200 Jewish survivors in our town, out of maybe 4,000 Jews in the town before the war. Maybe not quite 4,000 by then. But I'm one of those three children, and one is sad about all that were lost. And that is a sadness that will not go away. I feel somehow in the end, I'm fortunate to have survived. I do feel very much like a survivor, and I'm happy for that. It colors my outlook for life. I'm thankful for every day I can walk, and I try to be thankful for every moment that I have.
You mentioned that your parents or your father's last name was Safran. I believe Safran. You were born as Roald Safran too.
Right.
Tell me about the switch to Hoffman. How did that happen?
Oh, it happened in stages. So it has to do with geopolitical things and where we came from. I was born as Roald Safran. My father's name was Hillel Safran. My father was killed when I was almost six in June, the end of June in 1943. Right after the war, when we were back in Poland, in Krakow, my mother remarried a man who had lost his wife during the war. So there was a lot of this. People were anxious to get on with their life. I have a picture of my mother in Krakow in a new coat. That's the first thing she did after the war. I have pictures of me in refugee camps and our children in the classes from every age because they had not gone to school in the war, but we were all in the same class. My mother remarried, and my stepfather's name was Naftali Margulies. He was another Jewish survivor. And so my name became, for all of about a year, Roald Margulies. And then, on the way out of Poland, we bought the documents of German soldier who had been killed in the war. So now comes a double story. One has connections to our times. One is the story of why we did this. We did this because we knew about your American immigration laws, and we wanted to go to America. And we knew, just like the refugees in Bangladesh and Kenya know today, that something about the immigration laws. And we knew there was a quota under discriminatory regulations in the United States that was larger for Germans than for Poles. This is strange. This is discriminatory for racial reasons, American racial reasons. And so it was good to become German. The second thing was the Poles were busy chasing out the Germans who had remained in Schlesia, in Silesia, and they took away the money from a village, from the priests, from the villages, German villages, and a village priest in a German village in Schlesia, not far from Breslau, decided to support his congregation by a process which hurt absolutely nobody. He sold the birth certificates, since the church was in charge of keeping records, he sold the birth certificates of Germans who had been killed in the war as soldiers. I mean, this bizarre story, but this is a typical wartime story. And so, overnight, Naftali Margulies became Paul Hoffman. And my uncles, who were in a business, uncle who was in the business of forging papers, forged a wedding certificate between Paul Hoffman and Clara Rosen, and my real father disappeared from the legal document scene. And I was renamed Roald Hoffman. So that's how I became. Should we have changed back? Nah, it would have been too complicated, would have drawn attention to our, in some way, illegal immigration to the United States, because we came on false papers. No, I remain Roald Hoffman. Fortunately, I'm very happy and proud of that Norwegian first name, because if you have a last name that's common, like Hoffman, which could be a Jewish German name, could be a German name, but Roald helps to set me a little apart in the memory of chemists trying to remember my papers.
You were 11 years old when you migrated to the US. What made you choose chemistry as your profession?
Chemistry, and made a commitment to it rather late. So I began as a young boy with the usual kind of chemistry experiments people do, making gunpowder, painting it on paper, doing some chemical experiments, a few flasks some relative had found, nothing serious. In high school, the only advanced course in a science-oriented school I did not take was in chemistry. I took them in physics, math, and biology. That's because the teacher was not so great. In college, I started university. In our system, you go to university first, no matter whether you go to somewhere later. There was a lot of pressure to become a doctor. I didn't want to be a physician, I was headed in that direction when I began the university. So I took a lot of chemistry. I did well in that. I did well in everything at Columbia University. But the world opened up in the arts and humanities, in courses in poetry, history of art, especially in literature. And these influenced me tremendously at the university level. It's part of a sort of general education, which is typical of better American colleges and universities. And I got enough courage by the end of the university to tell my parents I didn't want to be a doctor. But I didn't have enough courage to tell them that I wanted to be an art historian. That would have killed them, I thought. It did, wouldn't it? But it was not in the sort of menu available to a child of an immigrant culture. And you know, it is exactly the same today at Cornell University, except that it is now the children of the Korean and Chinese immigrants who have the same pressures that I felt as a child of Jewish immigrants from wartime Europe. We know we have to study. Our parents want us to be doctors or engineers, and the kids have to fight to be something else. So I started graduate school in chemistry because it was the easiest thing to do. But I wasn't sure. Even in the first 2 years in graduate school, I sat in on courses in public policy, archaeology, and astronomy. And I took a year off after 2 years in graduate school to go to the Soviet Union in 1960. This is Khrushchev period. This was not a thing people did very much. And I went on an exchange, official exchange. Only when I came back, having finished 3 years of graduate school, that I made a commitment to chemistry. And in 1 year after that, I had a PhD. So I'm a latecomer to chemistry, not a typical course there.
A latecomer when it comes to chemistry, but you are very early when it comes to receiving the Nobel Prize in chemistry. I believe you were 44. Yeah. That is young that. And it seems like, well, I mean, after that, you could have retired. I mean, what else can you wait for after receiving such a prize?
It is what you point to and expressed in other words is an interesting thing, a problem for Nobel laureates. let me just say from the outset that getting a Nobel Prize is very nice, but it is an unalloyed good, only for my mother and my university, for different reasons that are obvious. But for the Nobel recipient, it's not so clear. There are some good things, some bad things. And some bad things, not so bad things, but more difficult things, are not expected. One is that there are something as distinguished as Nobel Prize engenders envy and jealousy. And where that envy and jealousy from colleagues surfaces is, of course, in the dark, when they think that you cannot see them. And that is when they review your papers, and especially in research grant reviews. So, and it surfaces in even the words they use. So when I would make some mistake in a paper and it would be reviewed by referees, part of our normal life, instead of the reviewer saying, there was a mistake made here and this is what should be done, they would say, I would not expect a Nobel laureate to make such a mistake. So what's there is nastiness, a human quality, unfortunately, coming through. The question, though, that you ask is an important one. That is, before the Nobel Prize, I had the fortune to choose what I wanted to work on within the constraints of getting government support or such on it, and they were not big constraints. That was fortunate. Even if I could do that before, when the Nobel Prize happens, people keep asking you, sometimes explicitly, well, what are you working on now? What are you going to do next? And if you have the good fortune not to have asked yourself that question, after 10 people ask that question, you begin to ask it of yourself. This is not a good situation for an artist, if you want to view the scientist and thought as an artist. The artist doesn't want to be asked, what am I going to paint next? Because he often doesn't know, and he follows his instincts, aesthetic, and ideas, and he does the next thing. But too much thinking about, some thinking about what you're going to do is good, but too much concentration on what you're going to do is, I think, to a certain extent, destructive of the creative impulse. And that's true for science and art. So, yes, and I'm happy what I did. I remained a scientist. So, what I mean by that is I did not follow the usual seductions, which are to become a university administrator, the head of a foundation, some sort of honorific or administrative position. And I kept on doing basic science at about a similar level. Maybe it was a little easier to get the coworkers who came to me. I think they would have thought of coming to me anyway, but it became easier to some extent. So I'm happy with my life went on normally. I published twice as many papers after the Nobel Prize, not that the number matters, but they were also very good ones. So I'm happy.
Roald, you've always emphasized the importance of observing ethical principles in chemistry and the natural sciences in general. Are those principles clearly defined and unalterable, or are they subject to change? Do new ethical principles perhaps evolve within the natural sciences?
That's an interesting question. Do new ethical principles evolve? Some to a small extent, the technology forces some different kinds of things, but most ethical principles are there, the same ones. They are, this, I think scientists are pretty fully formed ethical human beings by the time they become scientists. It does not hurt, it certainly helps to discuss them, because a lot of ethics is formed in discussion with other people about what is right or what is not. The ethical situations that are new are ones that often are evolved from the tools that you have. And we have seen this in the case of the internet and the World Wide Web, where there is coming up new questions of who you should ask for permission to reproduce something, who has the right to say something about someone else and to distribute it. But by and large, things are as they were. I think we, as scientists, we have a primary responsibility to ask about the consequence of our actions. Is what we do, invent, or do as scientists, will it in the first instance harm someone? Possibly. And second, can it be misused by others even? Nothing is simple, or the simple ones are probably not worth discussing much, but then there comes something like thalidomide, which is Contergan, which was something which caused birth malformations and was a problem in Europe and was stopped in the United States, fortunately for once, ahead of time. And that same pharmaceutical today is actually licensed with many, many warnings in the United States because it is a useful treatment for leprosy, and one of the few, apparently, that is effective. But it is still has the same problems it always had. And occasionally gets misused. So what should one do in that situation? I would actually say myself, but one should have a discussion about this. This is so useful. Case studies are so important. This is why, for instance, Jeff Kovac's book of case studies in chemistry is so useful and could be the basis for a course with students. Because you need to discuss specific ethical questions, how to deal with outliers in data, and what if your faculty advisor decides to disregard a data point, and it's not you who decide, what should you do? How do you? These are just interesting questions, and I feel it's also very important to discuss ethics. I am ranging a little widely from the initial question, but I feel it's very important to discuss ethical questions with students, because I found that students who usually are overly respectful of authority and are sometimes afraid to question the science that someone expresses in a lecture or a professor or their professor. Students feel empowered if you present them with an ethical case, like I just mentioned, of should you forget that data point. Students somehow feel empowered to discuss that, even in a group with their professor. That's very important. And the reason is that they themselves feel have feelings on ethical questions. And it's always good to have something where you can see a range of opinions. Here's a question, free speech, that comes up in a university setting. Whom should you allow to speak in a sponsored university lecture? Should you allow someone who belongs to an anarchist political party? Yes. Should you allow someone who advocates the abolition of child pornography? That's an interesting question. What you do is you outline a range of possibilities, and then you have a discussion around it. And it's very important for people to recognize that there are other people who have different ethical presuppositions from them. So I think it's important.
You mentioned harm a little while ago. Let me return to this term harm. As a matter of fact, a while ago, in 2007, you made this moral appeal in Turin at a conference, World Congress of International Union of Chemists. You said, regardless of whether you are making a gun or a molecule, a painting or a poem, you should always ask, could I harm someone with it? My question is harm per se bad? If I find out that I could harm someone by what I'm doing, does that mean that I have to stop?
Yes, I think so. I think occasionally one inflicts harm with consent. So one amputates a limb sometimes to stop gangrene. That is a decision not easy to take. One has to have the consent of the person. Is harm, I don't see how harm can be in any way good, or though I can see how you can, a doctor might have to make that decision. Are you harming a student by failing them out of a course in chemistry, by essentially telling them they cannot continue to a PhD? I don't know. I don't think you are harming them. You're making a decision on their abilities, and then someone else can decide whether they... Well, that's just giving it to someone else. I think one should try not to harm people.
But harm sometimes can be inherent in political satire, for example, in words, or even in art, in a sculpture,
yes,
or a painting. And sometimes it's needed to get a point across, right?
Sometimes a sharpness is needed, yes. The interesting question comes around art or poems and novels. So here is a case where artists sometimes think they can do no harm to people, that they cannot do anything that's unethical, well, aside from not fulfilling some contract or something. But people write in their lovers and partners into novels. What else will they use except material that they know? And sometimes those people are recognizable. And they may be still good works of literature, but I think there is some line that has been crossed when you use another person's life in a negative way. And I would say those are cases where the artist does harm to people. And I've written this play, Should Have, where I talk about just this, the ethical responsibilities of both scientists and artists. I think one should try to do no harm.
Well, for many decades you have connected the sciences with the arts to bridge the communication gap between the researcher on the one side and the public on the other side. First of all, why and how did you get interested in the arts? Was it a natural thing with being a chemist?
No, it did not come at all from being a chemist. It went from getting a liberal art education, as I mentioned, at Columbia with these courses and various things, and taking it seriously. And falling in love with literature and art. It was there from the university days. Its roots were in that education. Now, there was nothing otherwise in the family. There were no artists in the family. There were no musicians to speak of. Nobody played a musical instrument. One thing to say is maybe the war saved me from having violin lessons. Because given, what I mean is, given the kind of family which I grew up, I surely would have been subjected to music lessons. And that sounds bad. Of course, it's not bad. Anyway, my sources are in appreciating art, keeping up with doing so, even when it was difficult in the beginnings of my scientific career, at least reading and looking at things, and pushing through to take the time to do it, because after all, there are just 24 hours in a day, and the science was so interesting and so addictive and so time demanding that to find time outside of science and the family, another thing that pulls on us, to find time outside of that for doing things in the arts has always been very difficult, but it's just spiritually important to me. I just love these things, and I love looking at art, at new art that I see. At the Kunstmuseum yesterday when we went, what was interesting was not to see another Picasso or Klee. What was interesting was the incredible assembly of North German and European art, which is just not part of our art museums in general, which tend to view medieval and Renaissance times in terms of Italian art and such, which I love, but this was something else, and there was a large enough selection, so it was interesting to look at.
But if I understand you correctly, art goes or can go hand in hand with the natural sciences in the sense that it can also serve as a communicator, as a help to bridge the gap of communication?
It certainly, the art can. Oh, it's because the scientists are not reflective on what they do, and yet what they do involves communication and words and in pictures, and chemistry, especially in pictures. I have loved that I was given the opportunity to comment on drawing and on illustration in chemistry and what it means. And I, in the first talk, for instance, there was just one slide where I had, when I was talking about art and chemistry, and I said, here is this bunch of people who are forced to communicate three-dimensional structures of molecules, but they are not talented in doing so. And so what do? They invent a primitive art form somewhere between caricature, a kind of semiotics, indoctrinate students, and then they can communicate. And I think it's so wonderful. As something I didn't talk about then is also the visual tactile link, so that the chemists, when they indoctrinate students into how to draw a tetrahedron in a primitive way, they also make them build a model of that and move it in their hands while they draw it. It's absolutely amazing what is going on there, and the chemists are not aware that they're doing anything like a formal artistic training, but they are in some way, and that's so interesting.
You mentioned this interesting lecture you gave about art and science here in Basel. This is not the only lecture you're giving while you're here. You're invited by the Dreyfus Foundation, but you're also invited by the NCCR, Molecular Systems Engineering, because you wrote an opera, a melodrama. You wrote the text for it called Alchemy, which is a story about a female supercomputer called Ada. And in this piece, you portray Ada as a very sympathetic, almost human computer who unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, makes mistakes. And during the premiere of Alchemy, I was torn between feeling sympathy for Ada and being scared of her. Yes. Help me.
In this one-act opera, whose idea first came actually from the composer, Oliver Peter Graber, but I modified it substantially, but I worked into it some of the problems that concern me now about artificial intelligence in science and in society too. And that is, Ada is the sciences drive it in the direction of doing something perhaps without thinking about any ethical questions attached. And then something goes terribly wrong, as things often do. And then it's interesting that it is Ada who, at the same time, she helps the scientists do these calculations. And in fact, she is much more than just a helper. She's a collaborator, and they don't recognize some of them. But then they do something, and a mistake is made by her or the scientists. It's not clear. And then she fixes it, but in the process also sacrifices her existence, half machine, half computer, half human being. I think we should be afraid of the things artificial intelligence introduces in our lives. And when we see what has happened with the internet, which has such incredible potential, and it does in the right hands, but at the same time, the internet and all the ways we have of communicating via social media, it's as if they have set loose the evil spirit in us onto the land. So I mentioned the bad things that someone might say about my paper in a review, but if you look at the comments that people on the internet have about politics or other things, they feel free because they think they are not identified. They feel free to say terrible, terrible things about other people or about politics, so that something has been let loose by this genie out of the bottle. I worry about it. And so the world is changing. Our sense of privacy is vanishing, if it hasn't vanished yet. Our ability to remain human beings with our own identity has somehow been impaired by this tremendous power that also has been given to us. I think I know how to use it sensibly and ethically, but I'm maybe just deluding myself. I hope not.
Looking back on your career, these decades of learning, of studying, of finding new things, would you say that you know more now than you knew when you were 20?
Yes, I know much more. But mostly I have had more time to read. Not that I remember everything I've read. But when young people come in my office, they see all the books and they look how many books. Well, I tell them I've had more time than you to read those things. And if you keep an open mind, if you open yourself to the world, it'll keep on giving to you. There is just an infinity of things to learn, from small things like something I got to eat with the espargo yesterday, and it's called crezete, and I didn't know what crezete is. But now I know what crecite is. I've tasted it. So my experience has been added to knowing about the art of certain Indian tribes in Panama who make woven baskets of a certain kind. I can find that out on the web. It's just wonderful to be able to do that.
Well, you're still full of new ideas and ideas for new projects. You told me you wish you had more time to do them all.
At the same time as I wish I had more time, I don't regret, I don't feel bad about not having enough time. I mean, it's a wish. I think I've had so much time compared to my father, for instance, who was killed when he was 32. I have projects. In science, I would have liked to come up with a chemical theory of superconductivity. I've been interested in that phenomenon of conduction without resistance. There are hints that one could have a chemical understanding rather more than a physical one or in addition to a physical one. And I felt near it, but I haven't had the time to explore it. And now I won't have the time. That's okay. I've wanted to write another play about, I mentioned on a Japanese theme, about a Japanese god who in fact is frightening and impressive and powerful, but who is for some reason is afraid of hurting people, so he works only at night and to avoid frightening people during the day. And it sort of interested me as an idea. I've written three poems on the theme of that god, but I think that one could write a play. I have had ideas for some other plays. So why do I like plays? I think plays are a special way. There's something special about plays. The idea that someone's in front of you and they're human and they're saying things. There's a kind of concentrated conversation. It's not just a recording of some people talking on a streetcar. But second, you know that they are not who they really are, but you still know they're human, so you lose yourself in a moment. You suspend doubt, and you see them for what the roles they play. I think that is so interesting and so powerful. So I think a play has more emotional power because they're real human beings, especially if they're good actors, than actually a movie or a novel, though I love novels. When I listen, these days in the last few years, I have listened to more books while taking long walks, playing off my telephone through earphones, downloaded, but I think I've listened to more books than I've read, actually, in the last few years. And it's just wonderful. So I listen only to novels. I read some nonfiction, but I actually read more novels than I do nonfiction. I think novels also are very interesting because they're one of the few human forms where you get into what people think, and that's what you can. In a novel, someone has imagined how people think. I love it.
Coming to an end, do you have one message to the young researchers of today?
I think one is to be reflective, meaning stop once in a while to think about what you're doing and what meaning it has in the overall sense of things. So when you make a drawing in a chemical paper, think about the relationship of making that drawing. You've done it on a computer to what other people using illustrations, whether in advertising or in high art, either one. What is involved in that? Reflect on what is going on and what you are doing when you, not all the time, not before, you do what you have to do, but then just once in a while stop and reflect. I also think that to the young people that they should have confidence in what they do. They are faced with decisions, who to work for, what problem to work on, little ones, what journal to publish, where to apply to graduate school. And it sometimes feels like those decisions change their lives. They may, but have faith in yourself. It turns out that anything you do, if you do it in a concentrated, intent way, will actually turn out to be good. And it'll turn out to be original because you are not original. What I mean by that is we put together what we do from the experience of what we have learned by reading other papers, listening to lectures, listening to your teacher or several teachers. But because you will make a combination of those things in the science, it will be original. It will be permuted in some new way. And I'm so happy to see that in young people, my former students, for instance, what they've done with little pieces of what they learned with me, mixing with other little pieces and assembling a mosaic of something new.
Roald Hoffmann, thank you very much for inviting us into your world and for being such a generous teacher. Wish you all the best, good luck and health.
Thank you. Be well.
Das war der Draußentester für heute mit Roald Hoffmann, Chemie-Nobelpreisträger und Wissenschaftskommunikator aus den USA. Der nächste Draußentester kommt bestimmt. Bis dahin, tschüss und ciao, ciao.